From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. My first guest, and my only guest tonight, I first interviewed as a assistant district attorney for Los Angeles County, and then I have interviewed her as a author and as a analyst on television and as a victims advocate and as a, well, just about anything. And people have been wondering, where the heck has Robin Sachs been? And she's back. Hi, Robin.
Hello. So happy to be here.
Where have you been? I haven't talked to you, I think it was the 80s, I think, last when we talked, wasn't it?
Hey, now you're talking about my favorite generation. Don't mess with that.
Yeah, exactly.
I have been, you know what? I have, I've circled the media world. I've ended up back in the legal chair. I'm doing a lot of legal work, and now I kind of have found the balance in between both, but I have some other career vendors coming up, I guess, as you would say, in the future with some little projects that I'm taking on. So I'm a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
Well, we'll see what we'll see what I can pry out of you as the night goes on. Now, it's
not drinking.
Let's talk politics a little bit. The big primary in California. What do you think? Is this the craziest political season that you've ever seen?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, yes, and I voted, I want you to know. And the coolest part about voting today for me was, first of all, I was I was an undeclared party, and they gave me the option because I was undeclared and I was normally a mail-in person that did not mail in time, so I had to go in person. They actually gave me the opportunity to be a nonpartisan voter who participated in that I had an opportunity to choose a party and vote in the primary. So I was actually able to participate in the primary, which I was very happy to do, just because I felt like I needed to be, I needed to touch this election in some way.
Well, it's got to be crazy, you know, that when you watch politics, and Canadians watch American politics probably more than they watch their own, and to see these characters that are out there, Trump especially, it's got to make you sit back and wonder where you're country is going to be in the next 4 years. What do you think?
You know, it really frightens me, actually. I mean, it is a completely frightening election, and it goes to show you, I mean, first of all, just how fed up people are with the way things have been. To have a Bernie Sanders and a Donald Trump just even exist, you know, we are so off the mark. It's so representative of kind of what I've been feeling and seeing in life on a daily basis, and I'm sure what you see and feel on a daily basis. I mean, just the vitriol, the hate, the way people are, you know, this election has brought out the worst of people, and it's really disgusting out there. I mean, I feel it in court all the time. I feel it, you know, I do a lot of hearings with the DMV on behalf of people who have gotten DUIs. I deal with prosecutors, and I was a prosecutor. I deal with judges. And, you know, people are just so angry. And that's what you feel. I mean, you see the people, you know, the Bernie people who are supposed to be so calm and quiet, or those are the ones burning down the places at the Trump rallies. You hear Trump speaking the view that he speaks, and, you know, vile stuff that comes out of his mouth, and the people that support him. I mean, the fact that I'm even, you know, forced to make Hillary my gal is kind of not what I would have ever imagined.
Yeah, no, exactly. Robin Sachs is here, and I'm just so tickled to have her back that we're going to talk about a little bit of everything. You know, you talk about DUIs for many years here, as you know, in my career as a police officer. I spent time lecturing to a group in what we call up here the driving without impairment classes after the fact. In order to get your license, you got to listen to Dana Pretzer for a few hours tell you about how you shouldn't drink then drive. What about that? You know, 33 years as a cop, spent time as an ambulance EMT, and doing all these shows and all this sort of stuff. Drunk driving just isn't going away. It's still there. Now, the process is there, and you, as a defense attorney, are part of that process, and I respect that. But what can the world do about drunk driving?
Well, it's interesting. You know, first of all, I just as a side, you being in Canada, I got to tell you, you guys are tough up there. I mean, as a matter of fact, I mean, you get a DUI here in California, first-time conviction, person has no record, and let's just say that they were, you know, one of those people who, you know, I'm not talking about the 0.25 people who are plastered. I'm talking about the person who's like a 0.09, 0.10, who just doesn't happen to drive along with a, you know, needle in their car to test their blood to know whether they're just over or not over in terms of their blood alcohol level. I'm talking about people who are just regular people. And Canada, you can't enter into Canada with a DUI. It is really hard for, and I'm talking about for travel, for visitation. I'm not even talking about for immigration purposes. I mean, Canada is one of our hardest countries to deal with, one of the biggest consequences. So it seems that you guys have a really good approach there. But I have to say, it's really amazing to me that, you know, that I have as many cases as that I have. Even in California, where we're not necessarily the most public transportation friendly folks, and we're like our cars, and we're, you know, like our flashy cars and what have you, it's pretty universally seen as unacceptable at this point getting DUIs with Uber and Lyft and all of the awareness that's out there. I mean, every time I get into an Uber, and I'm a big Uber, you know, user, I ask the driver, I'm like, you know, so tell me about DUIs and whatever, and the kind of common thread comment that everyone seems to make is, how do people get DUIs even? How is it possible that DUIs are even an issue anymore? You know, it doesn't cost as much to get a ride. And so what I see is that the people that are getting DUIs, more, I mean, yes, there are the people who've made the bad judgment calls. I mean, there are those cases here and there. But what I'm finding is that more and more of the people getting them are truly people with serious alcohol issues.
Yep. No, I couldn't agree more. You know, there's the guy that makes the bad choice, but then there's the alcoholic, and, you know, that's another topic for another day. Robin Sachs is here. One of the big stories that has been in the media lately, and it's always coincidental that there's another docu-series, and I'm going to ask you about Making a Murderer a little bit later, but former LAPD officer and O.J. acquaintance Ron Shipp is saying that O.J. is going to confess to the murders of Ron and Nicole. Is this just PR for this mini-series or whatever documentary that's coming up, or do you think there's something to that?
You know, God, I mean, like, I'm as obsessed with O.J. as everybody else has been, you know, and I've, you know, that was the case that was the one that where I began my career. I mean, I was in 1994, I was in law school at Pepperdine, where Judge Ito recruited his law clerks from the Pepperdine class to serve, so my classmates, many of them worked on that case. I was in the LADA's office. You know, I am as obsessed as it can be. I follow all of these stories. But, I mean, I think that, you know, didn't O.J. try to confess with If I Did It or When I Did It with his book? I mean, I laugh at this point because I can't, there's no way that narcissist is going to really come ever out and straight out say, yes, I did it, and get anybody and give us the satisfaction that we really want to know. You know, it's going to be, I could have done it. Yeah. I was thinking, I had a dream that I did it. You know, I mean, it's not going to be the confession, I don't think, that we all want to have or hear.
I get it. 20 years later or whatever it is, and but even today, with the big California primary and all the other primaries going on and everything else going on in the world, they had a 3 or 4 minute segment about O.J.'s recent mugshot and how he was smiling in it.
Like, right, he looked calm. Like, I saw that.
Good grief.
That too. I saw that too, yes. Well, listen, it's the gift that keeps on giving. I did watch that miniseries, though, and I'll tell you, I learned some things. There were things, not everything was completely accurate, and obviously there was a lot of drama, but there were so many, you realize how much you forget in a case. When you watch and you go back in time and you go, oh, my God, that's right. They had to go fly to whatever that court was to go get the tapes, to get those Furman tapes, and then Cochran had to go make that argument to that other judge. I mean, you kind of forget that, and that's, isn't that a little bit of kind of what's going on with Cosby, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's all these things that are going on that you'll remember the charge, you'll remember the injustice, but you don't necessarily remember all the steps that it took to get there or not get there in O.J.'s case.
I was lucky enough to be able to interview Chris Darden and you at the same time. And what about the players? Do they ever get sick of it? Do they wish it would just ever go away? Or are they accepting the fact that this story is just going to keep going on?
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, I can tell you that I'm friendly with Kim Goldman. I see her every now and again. I've actually been on her radio show. And she cannot stand any time that O.J. Simpson's name is in the media. Every single time, I can only imagine how she feels with this recent, look at the first photo of O.J. in 3 years.
Jeez.
She wants to hear, look at us now. Look at my kid. Look at my life now. Look at how, where we are. Why is all this focus always on O.J.? And I think she really has had enough of it. I mean, she wasn't watching the documentary. And I think that, and Chris Darden, I've had the opportunities over the course of years to talk to him. I think that he, listen, I don't think that this was a happy memory for him necessarily either. And I don't know how he personally feels, but I do know that when, during the course of the miniseries coming out, I'm friends with him, and I was watching dialogue on his Facebook, and I commented on something, and then he sent me a note saying, do you think I should go on TV to talk about it? And, I responded. He didn't respond, but he obviously went on to talk about it afterwards. So, listen, he's a criminal defense attorney. Is there benefit to going on? I mean, there's all kinds of things.
Sure. I understand. Robin Sachs is here. If you want to learn more about her, listen to my show, for God's sake. No, click on the link in the show notes, and you can find out about one of the first guests that I ever had on this program that was worth a damn, to be quite honest with you. let's talk about Making a Murderer, the Netflix 10-part series, which drove me insane watching it. And apparently there's going to be Making a Murderer Part 2. There's going to be a documentary about the Menendez brothers, all the sort of stuff. For you who have had many hats in the judicial system, what do these miniseries do?
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, first of all, it's kind of interesting because I'm in the middle right now. I have a documentary team following me on my own case right now.
Right on.
I can't talk about the details of it right now, and I don't know if it's going to go anywhere or not go anywhere. And it's a very interesting story. But what I'll tell you is that when it was kind of Making a Murder, Serial, and then I forgot the name of the Durst one.
Robert Durst. I can't think of
it. The one that was done with him. I mean, so you had these three in the last 2 years. You've had Serial, Making a Murder, and the Durst documentary, which has just lit on fire public interest, and it's always been, as an insatiable interest for crime. I will tell you that in pitching my own story that I'm working on right now, it's not my story, but someone else's story, it seemed like, I've got the next Making a Murder, and I think that a lot of these production companies are getting flooded with those. And what I think that people don't realize with Making a Murder, specifically, is that you had two students over the course of some 10 to 15 years who sat there and videotaped everything. It wasn't sending a production company out. It was no cost to anyone. And what happened was, and part of the brilliance of Making a Murder, is that by being those people who were out there filming it, they became the pool camera for all the networks. So they were able to fund their time by providing footage of these trials out to the local networks at the time. So, you know, that's not kind of the formula for what other people are bringing these stories to. I mean, what's happening, and I can just tell you with my own experience on my case that I'm dealing with now, is like I have a really, really interesting case. They've followed us probably for about, been in this case for about 6 weeks. They've followed us for about 2 of the 6 weeks. They've sent me home with a camera. So I'm now filming my conversations that I'm having at specific times.
Right on.
They're going to take it within the next week or two. They want to compile what we have and decide if Netflix or HBO or someone is interested in it.
Right on.
If someone's interested in it, they'll carry on, and if not, that's it. Then the question has come to my team, do we want to just do what Making a Murder folks did, which is, well, we've been taping it all on ourselves anyway because we know there's something very interesting here, and just hold on to it and do what they did and see what comes of it. See, the problem we have right now, which drives production companies so crazy, is we don't have the ending, right? When you go and bring Making a Murder to Netflix, they had 15 years worth of tape and they knew what the ending was. I'm still in the throes of my case, and it could be 10 or 15 years before we know what the ending is, which makes it a different equation.
How interesting, and I know with you being part of it, someone's going to pick it up because it's you take the ball and you run with it. And one of the stories that you and I have talked about over the years is a former Bolingbrook police officer by the name of Drew Peterson, who I interviewed a few times on the show here. You were one of the few people that sent me nice email after I interviewed Drew Peterson, that he has now been convicted of asking to get the DA in the case killed, putting a hit out on Jim Glasgow. What about Mr. Peterson? That story is one that's going to continue on, too.
Right. Well, and he just amazes me. I mean, that guy is just, you know, go away, Drew Peterson.
Exactly.
I mean, the fact that we're even having conversations about him, and the fact that, you know, we're still having, you know, that we're even dealing with a murder for hire case in the secondary, like, it the level of narcissism and bulliness, I mean, there's a part of me that's, you know, looks at him as he just loves the attention. He'll take the negative attention. He doesn't care.
Any attention is his attention. But what about these guys? Do you think that Drew Peterson will ever come out and talk about Stacy? Joran van der Sloot, all these years later, is still talking about, well, I'll finally tell you what happened to Natalie Holloway. And you, as a family, as a victim, as a victim's family, how do you ignore something like that? You know that it's probably not going to be true. But then again, you know, you hate using that term closure. It'd sure be nice to get some answers.
Listen, it's easy for me to say. It's easy for me to say because I'm not in the position of, you know, the Holloways and Stacey Peterson and these horrible cases where these families have had to suffer so much tragedy. So, you know, I defer to them, frankly, as to what they prefer. My perspective, though, is that there is nothing that any of these people are saying that's worth anything. I mean, even as an admission, I just have yet to see the scenario. I mean, listen, if Joran van der Sloot or Drew Peterson or O.J. Simpson, for the matter, wanted to come out and say, this is how I calculated the plan, and then they were willing to take a polygraph in terms of the veracity of what the admissions that they just made were, maybe I'd have some interest because then maybe there would be some real closure. But, you know, some bullshit, sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to use that word, but, you know, blaming, you know, cop out, I sort of responsibility, half-ass kind of confession. You know, no one, I don't think, gets closure from that. That just gets people fired up.
No, that's true. Robin Sachs is here, we're going to talk a little bit about everything. Now, what about you? Now, you have done radio, you've done television, you've written books, a prosecutor, defense attorney. Do you ever get a chance to have some free time?
I do. You know, I've been good about that in the last few years. I mean, I will tell you, I had a life change 4 years ago when I went through a divorce. And yeah. I'm going to just take a moment to talk about a good divorce, because I have, like, the world's best divorce. Like, my ex-husband and I get along really, really well. And we have a great co-parenting relationship. And I kind of actually, the project that I'd want to take on would be the, you know, teach people how to divorce in the way that I divorced. But at the same time, what that also did was it gave me an opportunity to take stock of things that really mattered. And when I was unhappily married, it was really fun being really busy because I really hated to be home because I really was unhappy. So, you know, going to do TV at 2 a.m. or flying to New York or whatever was a really great escape. But when you, aren't running away from home, then you want to be at home, and the idea of waking up at 2 a.m. to go on Good Morning America for, you know, 13 seconds for them to, you know, not ask the best question to not get paid, you know, is not necessarily worth it, especially once you've done it. So I've made some major life changes where I really evaluate. I mean, I do, you know, first of all, I don't do any sort of TV or radio that I don't like the people, which is why I'm here. Like, I would do anything for you because I like you and I want to do things for people that I respect and like. I certainly, you know, want to do it at hours that aren't going to make it, so I have to leave my family now. And I want to do things that make a difference. So I'm really picky about what I do, you know. It's worth it for me to do an hour at KABC or an hour with you because I get to have these in-depth, great conversations as opposed to, you know, let me go show up at ET and have them, you know, give them the money shot that they want, and, you know, while I'm running to a million other things, it doesn't work out that well.
And your little girl is not so little anymore.
No, she's not. I have a 14-year-old.
Holy crap!
Navigating the world of, you know, teen and all the things, you know, Snapchat and, you know, all those boundary issues. And it's interesting. I have this. A little bit of a reverse situation that a lot of people have. I mean, this is, I guess, you know, I don't know. This is some payback of different sorts. I mean, I was a pretty wild, boundary-pushing kind of kid, and, you know, I was so worried that I was going to have a kid like that. Like, my kid is the one who is like, Mom, you know, I can't go see that movie because it's R, and it's illegal for me to see an R movie. I'm like, who are you? I'm like, I was the one, like, selling tickets on the playground.
That's cute. I like that. Robin Sachs is here. I want to talk about our new prime minister, a guy by the name of Justin Trudeau. And I'm sure you've heard of him. Everybody follows him, the young, good-looking guy. He doesn't think twice about elbowing another politician in Parliament. He's talked about assisted suicide legislation and the legalization of marijuana. You and I have had this conversation many times over, and Canada is going to do that. It sounds like February or March of next year. Your thoughts on the Canadian situation, and will that ever happen to this extent in the United States?
Well, it's funny that you say it, because here in L.A. we had Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, and Antonio Villaraigosa, I used to call the playa mayor, because he was like a hottie. Every time you saw him, he was always like, you know, at a party.
Yeah.
Oh, there was never a Hollywood moment. So I'm trying to think of like the playa minister of Canada, who's, you know, smoking big fat doobies and passing brownies around or something over, you know, during some you know, prime minister address or something like that. I think that the world, I'll tell you, it was interesting. I was sitting in dependency court today, which is not family court, but it's a court where people take away kids based on parents' bad behavior, abusive behavior, or what have you. And the judge was sitting there, and an attorney was saying, you know, oh, she smokes pot and drinks and whatever. And the judge said, listen, I don't really care about smoking pot. It's going to be legal here, you know, by January. And I'm just, you know, obviously I care if it's, you know, alcohol or drug abuse. But, you know, the mere fact of smoking pot is just not, it's just not a factor in this courtroom anymore. So stop talking about it. And I think that that's just the overwhelming view, although I've seen this recent undercurrent of news reporting coming out of, you know, of trying to you know, studies that try to correlate, you know, automobile accidents and
yeah.
deaths, and somehow to try to leap that into the marijuana, you know, and from the causation being marijuana. And I just think that, you know, if so long as alcohol is legal, I mean, pot is a no-brainer.
Yeah. No, and I guess the sign of the times, I'm thinking back to, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 30 years ago, and there's a different mentality now. But when you take that and then you correlate that with the legalization of drugs altogether, and then those that say that the, if it's mandated by the government and licensed and all that sort of stuff, like alcohol, then we wouldn't see the problems. I think that goes a little bit too far.
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, and so long as we have an economy issue, like, don't talk to me about pot yet, you know, because we could single-handedly probably fix and balance the budget if we just legalized pot.
Yes, you know, that's true. Robin Sachs is here. With what you're doing now, the work that you're doing now, and DUIs and criminal defense work, so to speak, how big of a change from when you prosecuted to what you're doing now do you see in the courts, or is it just you're on the other side of the table?
Well, I have very mixed views. I mean, I'm not your, I guess, classic, just like I'm not your classic political person where I fit neatly under some label. I haven't abandoned all of my good judgment and victim rights advocacy because I now wear a defense attorney hat. I mean, what I've learned and what I feel now is, first of all, it was a very lonely switch from prosecution to defense, because let me tell you, the prosecutors, you know, didn't trust you, and the defense attorneys weren't exactly welcoming with wide open arms, you know, being thrilled to see me join their side of the table.
There you go. Yeah.
So it wasn't, you know, and judges kind of didn't know what to do with me. So I don't know that it was, you know, like, oh, this is great. And, you know, the thing that I really realized is that being a defense attorney is hard. Being a prosecutor is a lot easier. You know, as a prosecutor, you have a detective, they do the work for you. You may even have some DA investigators that do the work for you. And then, you know what, if your case doesn't, you know, your witness doesn't show up that day or something doesn't come into place, you know, you dismiss it. And if it's a felony, you get another bite at the apple. If it's a misdemeanor, you don't. But whatever, it's just a misdemeanor. You're going to get paid the same whether you convict 12 people that day or 10 people or no people or whatever. And you get a leave, and if, you know, and life kind of goes along in a nice, smooth way. From a defense attorney perspective, you know, not only do you have to deal with, you know, getting clients and marketing yourself, but then you have to deal with people who are in crisis. I mean, people who are calling defense attorneys are not calling them because they're, you know, it's a great day in their life. They're not. It's not the adoption case, right? This is a case where something, you know, jail and life and freedoms and liberties are being taken from them, and you are on the defensive. And so my job now is to try to appeal to the reason very often of lawyers who, you know, are half my age, who have no life experience, who have some officer or detective who's done all the work for them, who can't be bothered to read the police report, who, you know, don't necessarily look at the individual strengths and weaknesses of a case. Like, I'm all about recognizing the value of a case, but I'll tell you, there is nothing that is more pressure from a defense attorney perspective than representing someone that you do truly believe is innocent. And that has been a huge eye-opening experience. And if I were to do one thing, I would make every public defender and every DA require them each to spend at least 45 days as an attorney on the other side. I would work out some exchange program between the DAs and public defenders so that there is an appreciation of how hard client control is, how hard getting your, you know, dealing with what you deal with as a defense attorney is. And frankly, for defense attorneys to see how difficult it is to work with law enforcement, too.
Speaking of law enforcement, You know, you can bring up Ferguson, you can bring up all the, you know, Black Lives Matter and all of that. And, of course, you know where my heart will be. But what about law enforcement today? You've worked with them, you've lectured to them, you know them. It's very difficult to be a police officer, man or woman, today in society. Body cams, all that sort of stuff. And I know this is a loaded question for you, but it's tough. And I'm curious from your perspective as Robin Sachs, not necessarily the defense attorney or the prosecutor, but just Robin Sachs, the person, I'm curious to get your thoughts on policing in 2016.
Listen, I think that I am so saddened by how disrespectful people have been to law enforcement. I mean, they serve such an important role in our society, and they do things that none of us can, and, you know, a lot of us can and aren't able to do. And, you know, it's an incredibly difficult, stressful, moment-by-moment job that, you know, add to it now everything, you know, I know what it's like, you know, when I'm filmed and someone takes just a snippet of what I say and how they manipulate it into a potential argument to fit some story when it's not fully given the context that it deserves and what have you. And so I'm very pro-law enforcement. I'm pro-law enforcement as a defense attorney, too. I mean, I think we need to be – I think that this environment, and it kind of goes back to how we started this radio show at the beginning, which is we live in this disgusting world environment of just hate and extreme. And, yes, are there bad cops and bad decisions and things that have happened and are in bad ways? Absolutely. Are there bad cops? Yes, of course there are. But, I mean, you don't burn down the country because of, you know, few bad cops.
No. And, again, it's a recruitment and retention aspect of it also, because you want to keep the good ones. But, you know, you can understand their frustration. Robin Sachs is here. This is great. I haven't been able to have her for the whole program for quite some time, and I appreciate your time. Thank you for that. You know, I've got the television on in the background and all the politics and Donald Trump and all of this stuff. So I want to talk to Robin Sachs, the media person, a little bit now and get your thoughts on Trump, Megyn Kelly, that whole schmozzle that went on for some time, and you as a female, and how difficult is it for you to deal with people like Donald Trump?
Well, I'll tell you, this is the thing. I mean, I was very open to Donald Trump at the very beginning of his candidacy. I was not going to poo-poo him right away. I was not a hater by any stretch of the imagination. I had an appreciation that he was willing to say things that other people were too scared of saying. I mean, I like that about him. I did think that was good, and I do think that, you know, kind of not necessarily being, you know, tied to just this political correctness, you know, hand job that you get from most politicians, it was a refreshing breath of fresh air. But just like everything, and just like anything and everything, there's balance to that. And the problem that I had, I mean, there was a tipping point that I had for me, and I think that the litmus test for everyone finds kind of, you find the line, and at that point, you step over it. The line for me was when he did not immediately denounce the endorsement from the KKK guy. You know, his kind of semantics that he, you know, threw around, his, you know, bad comments under pressure, I was almost willing to be able to forgive. But, you know, the KKK thing, and then kind of after that, I looked at everything, and I was like, you know, the issue that I have is how can you have someone so hateful sounding and get respect in other places? And that was where I really did kind of change my view of, I just, you know, if you, you know, and I, as I said, I've been no big Hillary fan in any way, shape, or form, but I just think that he's so scary that I, you know, you just don't even know where he stands. I mean, that's the issue. He has no track record. You don't know where he is, and then he's spouting stuff up. So, and then he's picking on Megyn Kelly, you know, throughout this whole part of, you know, throughout, so...
It was almost like a teenage crush that he had on her, and by bad-mouthing her, he was trying to get her to like him or something. I don't know. It was very bizarre, for sure. I want to talk about some history here a little bit, and all the years that you and I have done this program and the topics that we've talked about and the cases that we've talked about in the social media aspect of it, the big media aspect of it, crime, punishment, politics, you name it. Let's go back to the early days of you being on my show and compare them to today. There is a lot changed in the world, but then again, there's a lot of people out there that are still looking for answers. There's still a lot of missing people out there. There's still a lot of battered women out there. There's still a lot of laws that need to be changed. There's still a lot of good cops, bad cops, in-between cops. So what about that? What about you and me on this show 10 years ago compared to today?
Well, I think, first of all, listen, I think that you're doing what you do and have continued to do what you're doing is such a it's so nice to see. I got to tell you, it's so heartwarming to come onto your show, you asking these tough questions, you chasing these good stories, and you putting yourself out there when this is something that's not easy. I mean, that you work a full-time job, you have a full family, and you're, you know, asking these tough questions. I've always, you know, I kind of want to rather turn the microphone on you and say, I'm curious to know how, you know, what support you get from your colleagues or lack of support in terms of just doing the show. And then I'll reminisce. I'm just curious. I've always been curious about that. I mean,
it's always been a eyebrow raised, but then sit back and say, how do you do that? I guess we all have to have a hobby. I consider this to be more than a hobby, and I just have fun doing it. And I'm going to keep doing it until they tell me I can't anymore.
Has your boss ever called you and said, you know, I can't believe you said this on the air? I mean, I always used to worry about that when I was in the DA's office.
Yeah, exactly. No, I've never had that problem.
Well, so that's good. So then you haven't had that kind of experience, which is a great thing. And I think that it's interesting. I mean, media, just generally, everything has changed so much. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, when you and I started the show, or when you started the show and I got the pleasure of being a guest on the show, rather, you know, it was still the time where if there was, you know, a fire or smoke outside, you would go, oh, let's go turn on the news and see what's going on. And if they didn't break in, you would actually wait till the 5 o'clock news came on to see what the heck was going on. Like, that is a laughable concept now. I mean, when was the last time that, you know, you heard helicopters overhead or, you know, saw smoke and didn't just immediately go to your phone and start, you know, looking in Twitter and Facebook and your news sources and what have you? So I think just from the instantaneous availability of news and the quick just soundbite. I mean, the thing that I find so refreshing with your show that I don't see, because we are, you know, in headline era. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the news app called The Skim.
Yes.
There's a show that just launched here in L.A. It's actually one of a young student who is an intern who I helped get this job is one of the stars on a show. It's called 30 for 30 or something. It's 30 headlines in 30 minutes, which means one-minute headlines. And I'm thinking, you know, the refreshing part of your show is your depth and analysis. And, you know, I don't know how much more you can skim off the top before you're just, like, you know, having little shavings of news. I mean, so to get into something, to understand something, to get the real story behind something, I mean, how many people just post articles because they've read the headline and maybe the first sentence of an article and decided that's what it is, only to maybe that doesn't even represent who they are. So what I think that has changed is our attention span. What I appreciate about your show is that you continue to stay deep.
Thank you, Robin Sachs. You've given me 40 minutes of your time, and I appreciate it completely, and we'll talk soon.
And the bill will be in the mail. Let me just make sure. Pretzer.
Right on. You know my address.
It's my pleasure. And more importantly, I just wanted to say a big shout-out to your son, who he worked with me. You know, I have a very special relationship with your son. I mean, he was here and worked with us at Al Jazeera. He was part of this group. I'm actually happy that, you know, in light of what happened with Al Jazeera, that he didn't end up there in the end because none of us were there in the end. So,
well, he's going to be in Washington D.C. in about 3 weeks. So good for him.
Well, shout out to him and tell him I say hi.
All right. Thanks, Robin.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Robin Sachs, a former Los Angeles County District Attorney, a legal analyst, a defense attorney, a victims advocate, a professor, law instructor, you name it. She's done it, and a great friend of the program. You know, in my 33 years of policing, recently retired, I guess Robin doesn't know that, but that's okay. I learned one thing as a law enforcement officer is you go out and you do the best job that you can. Men and women in emergency services get paid very little to do a lot. A lot of the time it's very mundane, but then there's times of sheer excitement, sometimes terror, that you go out and you sacrifice your life to protect others. You do the best job you can. Yet there are those out there with video cameras and law books and defense attorneys and people that just want to cause trouble for you and try and catch you at your weakest. So men and women in law enforcement have to remember one thing, is not only are your eyes on everything around you, but other people's eyes are on you. So you have to do the right thing. Make sure and do the right thing because we count on you. One thing about being retired now for almost a year is that I completely miss the job. Some ask me if I would return. I would go back tomorrow if I had an opportunity and work in a mentoring role, but I'm not sure that will ever happen. But one thing I ask you as the listener and I ask you as the viewer on Access 7 is respect when women and men in law enforcement because they are doing the job that you probably don't want to do. Okay, that's it. That's the show tonight on Scared Monkeys Radio and Access 7. I appreciate it. Thank you, Robin Sachs, for joining us, and we'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.